When he retired from the military in 1971, Colonel David Hackworth was probably the most decorated officer in the American Army, but he was also one of the military's most outraged and bitter internal critics. At the age of 14, Hackworth ran away from his orphanage, and at 15 he volunteered for the Army. He received a battlefield commission in Korea when he was 20, and was wounded 4 times before he turned 21. In 1965, he went to Vietnam, where he was a battalion commander, held several advisory commands, and gained a reputation as a heroic and creative leader. But by 1971, he lost his faith in America's military leadership, and he detailed the reasons why on network television in an interview on ABC's Issues and Answers. After the interview was recorded, he filed for his retirement. For the past 18 years, Hackworth has lived in Australia, where he's become a successful entrepreneur. In his new memoir, About Face, Hackworth describes his life as a soldier and why he left the military that had for so long been his home. Hackworth is said to be the model for the character of the renegade Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando, in the film Apocalypse Now. I asked him where the similarity begins and ends.
I commanded a separate element down in the Delta, very similar to the character in Apocalypse Now, and he seemed to be a water walker of a colonel. That meant somebody that was talked about going to be onward and upward in the military system, and he quit, and he went to Cambodia and lobbed off heads and painted his face with camouflage and got very, very fat, as we saw in the movie. And and he kind of went bananas. And I went to Australia and opened a snack bar and sold banana splits. So I think that's the connection. And that's not like a Hollywood ending for a movie. So I think that, yes, the character was modeled after me. I know that when I was in Australia and I was in my alternate lifestyle phase right after I got out of the Army, I was approached by a couple people who were producers who asked me to be a technical advisor for the film. And I was also told by Colonel Foley from the Army's public relations that it was modeled after me. So that's about what I know. I refused the job because I wasn't into war anymore.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that part a little bit later. Why did you make the Army your home until 1971?
I loved it. I love military men. I love the dedication, the discipline, the spirit, all those good things that make up warriors. And I came from a background in 1620, my family got very angry with King George, and they came to Virginia, and when it was a little colony, and with a musket in one hand and axe in the other, they chopped their way from Virginia to California, and I was kind of genetically programmed from that experience and from the tales of my dear grandmother about warriors to be a warrior. So that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to serve my country, and I couldn't think of anything higher calling. And that's the point, that when I was a young soldier, being a soldier was a calling. It wasn't some way to advance yourself to the higher levels.
Let's talk about your experiences in Vietnam. You went there in 1965 and stayed there off and on until 1971. You were there in many capacities, including working on a special mission to analyze some of the mistakes the American military was making in Vietnam. And you had many criticisms of the military over the years. I'd like to talk about some of those criticisms and how you reached those conclusions. First, you were saying that that you made the Army your home and everything, yet you became very critical of careerists in the military and of what was called ticket punching.
Well, I think, Terry, that you when you scope out the whole book, it goes from where I started my soldiering experience in Italy in kind of a time warp situation. I was in an army that didn't really exist anywhere but in Italy, and it was an army made up of sergeants that were the Burt Lancaster type characters from Here to Eternity, and it had that kind of old army 1930 kind of feel about it, and the discipline and the standards and the values I gained in those 4 hard years of being clumped on by NCO justice and all of that hardened me into a real believer and a really dedicated and professional soldier. I was taught the basics of if you don't get it right and do it right the first time around, you're going to do it wrong from then on. So those standards then continued. And, you know, we talk about at the end, here I started out in this great fine army that had this incredible discipline and standards, and I saw the army from then on go downhill, and I was always looking for that same goal. And the book is like 850-odd pages. Half of it deals with the Korean War, and it's come out to be the forgotten war. And those guys that fought there fought in terrible conditions against an overwhelming enemy, attacked us in great formations to where our machine guns were just running hot. And I describe all of this because that war was so important to understand Korea, from that setting of Korea, so you could then look very keenly at Vietnam, because the mistakes that we made in Korea, our army in the first year was sadly defeated. We went there under-equipped. We didn't have proper ammunition. Our soldiers hadn't been trained. Our generals were old and tired and fat and incompetent. And we got ourselves waxed, and we were driven back from the 38th parallel down to the Pusan perimeter. And it wasn't until we got great leadership, that was Matthew Ridgway, who turned the whole thing around, and that was one of the great military accomplishments of history, how one general can take a defeated army and very quickly shape it up and get us cracking. And we sailed north and just kicked the bejesus out of the North Koreans and the Chinese and so on. And when that Korean War ended, and the people in command of the army, the kind of Maxwell Taylor types who started all this self-serving careerist jazz, didn't want to know about Korea. So we didn't really learn anything. We swept those hard, bad, difficult, bloody lessons under the rug and got ourselves postured again to fight in Europe and tank battles and all of these good things that our senior leadership understood. And then came Vietnam, and we made all the mistakes again. What I saw was the military went from a high calling, a high profession, to just another job. And our generals went from that Ridgway type, that Patton type, that Gavin type, these inspirational warrior leaders, to corporate managers who had their PhDs and their masters from Harvard and so on, but didn't know diddly squat about leading soldiers and didn't care about their soldiers.
You were also very critical of the training that our troops had for guerrilla warfare. Now, later on, a lot of people were saying the same thing. You were saying this pretty early on. What were some of your experiences leading troops that made you realize how unprepared everybody was to fight in Vietnam?
There is training and there's training. And there was the training of going down and jumping into some place in Georgia and fighting for 3 or 4 weeks, but the individual soldier wasn't trained. He's sat on the edge of his foxhole. People who fight the war wars are the individual soldiers. And in war, if that soldier is well trained and knows the basics, it's like a football team. If you have a football team and you're good at blocking and tackling, then you don't need all that razzle dazzle. You can go ahead and win the ball game just on your basic skills. And what happened in the military is these corporate generals didn't understand the need for blocking and tackling, and hence the Army got so involved in these big esoteric maneuvers that the training value went right down the slope, and it was shown in Vietnam. And I saw where I really saw the tragedy of it all was in a battalion I commanded at the latter stage of the war, which was called the 4th Battalion, 39th Infantry in the 9th Division, when it was a battalion composed of what we called shake and bakes, of instant leaders, instant NCOs, instant officers, ran through Fort Benning for 12 weeks or 16 weeks and made sergeant, made lieutenant, and sent to the battlefield. Because everything in America is abracadabra, presto, instant type thing, and that's not the way to train an army. And so we made every possible mistake. Another experience I had in training was I commanded a training battalion at Fort Lewis, Washington. And a couple of examples was 50% of all casualties in Vietnam came from mines and booby traps, from these little insidious damn things that blew up and tore off your leg or killed you. And we had been into that war now 4 years at that time, and the total training that was given on mines and booby traps were 5 hours. There was no training devices like a little firecracker device that would explode when the soldier went through a training field and spray him with red paint so he'd know that he tripped a mine and was wounded. But at the same time, every full colonel and above in Vietnam had an air-conditioned trailer, and I became so insane about the way we were training, and I needed to know what it was all about and what we were happening, that I put on a private's uniform and wore a private's dog tags, a boy named Bob Cena, and went right through the training so I could find out what was happening, and I was appalled with what was happening. And so I took my troopers and trained them at night and trained them on Saturday and Sundays and so on to ensure that they got the right stuff, because when they finished that training, they were on a jet airplane, and a few days later, they were walking in the jungles of Vietnam.
My guest is Colonel David Hackworth. We're talking about his experiences in the military. He's the most decorated living military man. He's retired in 1971, left the military after being greatly disillusioned by his experiences in Vietnam. His new book is called About Face. You talk about the overemphasis in Vietnam on capturing territory and how we'd capture territory and then abandon it a few days later. And in the meantime, many men would have lost their lives in capturing this territory. The greatest example of that and of the pointlessness of it was Hamburger Hill, where so many men died, and then the territory was given up shortly after. Did you have an equivalent experience where you had to capture territory, a lot of your men lost their lives, and then you were told to give it up just shortly after?
Well, I think in the beginning, because my training was Korea, and I originally entered the Vietnam War with that kind of experience, and so initially we were focused on terrain objectives, meaning grabbing a piece of ground, and as we went on, I learned that that was not the way to fight the war. The terrain didn't mean anything. The way to win that war was to make the enemy bleed, and our problem was that our senior leadership just fought the war as if it were World War II and just fought it all over again. And they didn't understand the nature of the war. And a point, Terry, is that that war was probably about 30% tactical and about 70% political, meaning to win the hearts and minds of the people, which is a tired cliche, but it wasn't all on the battlefield. And our generals, our senior generals, didn't understand that either, that we were kind of wham-bam, let's go blow them away type army, and we hadn't really worked out what the war was all about. After the war was over, a study was done at the War College, which revealed that 70% of the generals who were involved in high-level slots in Vietnam didn't understand what the objective is. Now, if you don't understand what the game plan is, you ain't going to win many ball games.
One of your missions in Vietnam was to take over a sick battalion, a battalion that was in disarray, and to try to turn them around. When you got there and saw the troops, you found that at the command post there were portable toilets, plastic coolers, but the troops were living in complete filth and disarray. They weren't even covering their feces. That there was just this incredible difference between how the two groups were living. Would you describe that a little bit?
Well, that was the 4th Battalion, 39th. They kind of called themselves the Hard Luck Battalion because shy of my arriving, they had kind of waited around in minefields for 6 months and taken 500 or 600 casualties and hadn't really engaged the enemy. And it was a very demoralized unit. And my commander told me that he wanted it shaped up. And I think I was kind of brought in from the United States for that particular job. And so it took every bit of experience of my previous 20 years to get this battalion cracking. And it was just going back and instilling in those kids the basics. They were a drafty battalion. They were the shake and bakes I described earlier. And it was just a question of making sure that they did things the right way. And as days passed, we got better and better and better. We didn't fight in minefields. You know, I was taught as a little kid that a minefield was a no-no, and in World War II, we didn't play in minefields. But in Vietnam, minefields were where the enemy was. The whole focus was on body count. So you went into minefields, and it just blew the guys' brains away because every time they put their foot down, they didn't know whether they were going to have a foot, going to have a leg, going to have a life. And do that for 365 days, and hey, it'll do something to your brain. And so I had to change that, and I had to win these young 19 and 20-year-old boys to my way of fighting, which was, I'm on your side. I am not going to waste you. You are the most precious asset in the world, and I'm not going to just slam you up against a minefield or an enemy in a fixed position for glory or for a few medals or to make some points with my boss. And so I was a very frugal commander, and that spirit went down to my troops, as did my emphasis on the basics. And within 5 months, that battalion started calling themselves the Hardcore Battalion. And in the chapter in the book, I call it the Hardcore Battalion. And they, at the end, had killed over 2,500 enemy at the price of 25 American dead, 25 of our comrades who were killed. And that is, to me, the end result. If you could do that with a drafty battalion that started in that kind of raggedy condition, and they turned out to be a Praetorian Guard, it was just a byproduct, Terry, of leadership.
You didn't want to lead your troops into hopeless or impossible situations where you'd just be setting them up to be killed. Yet you had to go on some missions that you didn't believe in. And I think the kind of gravest example of that was Cambodia. You were against the bombing of Cambodia, but you had to participate in that mission.
Well, Cambodia was too little too late. We should have gone into Cambodia in 65, the minute the American forces got into the war. General Westmoreland, who was the commander-in-chief in Vietnam, should have said to the president, hey, listen, I want to blow away those sanctuaries. I want to blow away Haiphong. I want to blow away the Red River Delta dikes. I want to flood the whole bloody country. I want to win that war. I don't want to go in there with one arm tied behind me. I don't want to go in there gradually. If America's to fight a war, we got to win that war. And if the president wouldn't give him the good things he needed, that's the combat power and the free hand, then he should have resigned. My bitch with Cambodia was simply this. I believe that we should blow away the sanctuaries. We went into it 5 years too late. But what the basic thing that got me was, I believe in America and the ideals of America. And when we went to Cambodia and we didn't tell the Cambodian government, our allies, we didn't tell the U.S. ambassador in Phnom Penh, we just went in blatantly, not unlike the Nazis went into Poland or the Japanese into Pearl Harbor. And I wasn't into that. And that wasn't the American way. And that's the thing that kind of broke my heart.
In 1971, shortly after your experiences in Cambodia, you decided to go public with your disillusionment about the American military. You chose as the forum Issues and Answers, the ABC News program, and you did an interview on there that got incredible attention. What made you decide to go public at that time? Did you feel like you'd already been through channels and that hadn't worked?
Well, I'd been in Vietnam. I'd been in Vietnam a long time, and I had tried my very best to inform everybody in power that we were losing the war. In 1966, I had told the Chief of Staff of the Army, Harold Johnson, we were losing the war. In 1968, I had told the Chief of Staff of the Army, Westmoreland, that we'd botched the war and we were losing it. In 1969, I told the Secretary of the Army, Stanley Reeser, the same thing. And I told anybody and everybody that I could grab by the short of the stock and hold long enough that we were fighting the war wrong, we were paying an incredible price, and no one would listen. I was telling everyone in military publications and writing. Everybody was printing my word, but still nothing was being done. The Hardcore Battalion, this battalion you described earlier, went from heartbreak to hardcore, and we had this incredible battle experience, and the battalion was able to wax the enemy in every engagement with 100 enemy dead, 4 American wounded, and stuff like that. Nobody tried to learn from those hard lessons that we were fighting. And it just was like water on a rock. It went on and on and on until the rock broke. And when the rock broke, I said, look, We are a country of the people, by the people, for the people. I'm going to tell the people because I've told the institution it hasn't worked. So in a big, naive 40-year-old boy, I told everybody, and thinking, oh, well, now that's going to make some change. Sure did. I found myself with like a sledgehammer coming down on my tender little brain.
For example, what did the military do? What was the response?
Well, I didn't know anything about whistleblowing. And it's a taboo in the military to attack the military as such. And here I was, a regular officer, doing it. And remember, I didn't come up. I came up through the ranks from private to sergeant and sergeant to lieutenant and so on. So I didn't understand it was taboo. I had always, when I was a little kid in Italy, Eisenhower said to me, well, what do you think about the chow? And I said it was terrible, and he got it fixed. So I thought, all you have to do is tell your commander and he'll get it fixed. And so I was telling my commander, and General Westmoreland didn't quite appreciate what I had to say, and that's when the world fell in on me. And it fell in on me, the most obvious way of attacking me was through my credibility, that I was either nuttier than a fruitcake, or I was a bum, and I had done all these bad things, and hence you shouldn't believe what Hackworth has to say. So basically, that was kind of the campaign of terror that I endured for a few months. And while that was happening, my little constitutional rights were pretty well shredded.
When you retired from the military and your own military record was called into question, a couple of the things that were raised were controversial things that you had been doing while you were in Vietnam. Like, for instance, you ran, a massage parlor whorehouse?
Well, I had the best little whorehouse this side of the Mekong Delta River. But what was important, the reason that we had it was not unlike the French army when they were in Vietnam. They had the same type of service for their little troops. And it was because I had a team composed of mostly senior NCOs and officers down in the Delta, who's were isolated in this little island situation. We had syphilis that was in epidemic proportions around this area. We had heroin in the same kind of condition. So I put everything off limits. And warriors are warriors, and they like to fight, and they like to do other good things. So instead of taking the problem of having the heroin brought into my base, or the syphilis brought in, we corrected that by providing that good service for the Allied troops. And, you know, the function of a good commander is to look after his soldiers, and I always looked after my soldiers.
You had a heroin amnesty program. Describe briefly how the program worked.
Well, at that time, about 20% of the U.S. command in Vietnam had a problem with heroin. So what I did with my doc, a medical doctor, medically trained and all that good stuff, was very easy to see who was sticking a needle in his arms, because we were in the tropics and they had their sleeves rolled down. So it was just a question of identifying those guys, putting them under a medical program the doc ran. He brought them down on morphine, then we got them home. And the Army's way of dealing with this was to give everyone a bad conduct discharge. And I felt that they were victims, not unlike they'd been shot on the battlefield. And I felt it was my responsibility to get them home in good order. And so that's what our program was about. At the end, when they went out through Camp Alpha, they had to urinate in a little bottle, and this bottle could be read, and it could be told if they had been on heroin in the last 6 or 8 months. So I just sent another boy with them. We just out-G'd the whole system, and the other boy took a leak in the bottle, and they read out his urine, and the guy that had been using the heroin went home and was free, and he didn't have a $300 or $400 a day habit, and he could walk away from that terrible experience. So again, I was looking after my troops, and as long if I hadn't bit the hand that fed me, none of this would have come up.
But how did you get away with it for as long as you did?
Well, we were very competent and good, and we were winning all the ball games. And it's my experience that the commanders will suffer all kinds of insubordination and bizarre, weird behavior as long as you're winning ball games. And we indeed won ball games right until the day I left that country.
What kind of shape do you think the American military is in today?
Well, I've gone to the 7th Division, 25th Division, the National Training Center, I haven't been at the flagpole, but I've been down with troops at the squad, at the platoon, at the battalion. I'm very impressed with the young leaders. The young regular leaders are outstanding. The young NCOs and officers up to battalion level, which is the only place I've been, I'm very impressed. The Army looks very much like that damn great Army that we had 62, 63, 64, 65 before we bloodied it and broke its sword on Vietnam. So maybe we have learned, and I think that where I have been, which are the light divisions, which are the ones who got the mission to fight in Latin America, to fight in third world countries, to fight in wars like we've fought in Vietnam, I think they want to know what happened. And again, after the Vietnam War, the Army again, like Korea, swept it all under the rugs and oriented themselves to fight in Europe. But today, the guys I talk to, the guys at battalion level and below, want to know those hard lessons. So maybe we've learned. And as I said earlier, the Army never learns from its past. It's never been introspective. We always go into the current war with the memory and the tactics and the strategy of the previous war. Maybe at long last we've learned, and maybe, and I'm hoping that my book will serve somewhat as a guide, a training manual, a primer on the experiences, my experiences of the Cold War, so we just don't forget it and make those same mistakes over and over again.
David Hackworth, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for your time.